Welcome to Write Medicine, where we explore best practices in creating continuing education content for health professionals. I'm Alex Housen, and I'm on a mission to share expert insights and field perspectives on topics like adult learning, content creation techniques, effective formats, and trends in healthcare that influence the type of continuing education content that we create. Write Medicine is the premier podcast for CME CPD professionals like you, wherever you are in the content creation process. Join us.
Principally by supporting those who are providing learning to consider and think through why they're measuring what they're measuring. And in fact, decide what you're going to measure before you actually design everything else, rather than using the outcome, the evaluation form as the last thing that you design just before the first speaker goes on stage. Think of what you actually intend to deliver first, how you're going to measure it, and then how you're going to actually get that measurement right by your learning design.
Are you measuring educational outcomes but failing to capture the true impact on your learners? As a CME CPD professional, you know that proving the effectiveness of your educational programs is crucial. But in the rush to gather data and report metrics, it's easy to overlook the individual learner's experience and perspective. Relying solely on quantitative measures can cause you to miss valuable insights that could enhance your activities and programs. In episode 104, physician and longtime medical educator Dr. Dean Jenkins shares why it's essential to focus on the learner's needs and desired outcomes when you're designing education upfront, the importance of qualitative data in capturing the complexity of healthcare and the learner's voice, and how defining your target outcomes upfront can improve your learning design and measurement approach. Tune in today to discover how putting the learner at the center of your outcome strategy can help you deliver more impactful and meaningful education. Welcome, Dean. It's good to see you here.
Hi, Alex. Good to see you too.
Tell Write Medicine listeners who you are and what you do and find how you found your way into CME and CPD.
Well, I'm Dean Jenkins. I'm a physician in the UK. And as everybody who practices medicine, they are at some point involved in helping and teaching others. And really, that's how I got into education, is the classic see one, do one, teach one. When we're on the wards, we get to try out a new technique. And then you only really learn something when you get to the point of having to teach it to somebody else. So that's how I originally got into it. And I helped colleagues with passing the membership exam. In the UK, we have like the board certification exams. In the US, we have a college of physicians that I had to pass some exams into. And fresh out of the exams, I thought, well, I'll help my colleagues as well. So I started gathering example questions and making up questions of the sorts of things that come up in exams, and started having little groups. And when I got through the exams, I started teaching others more formally and forming little lunchtime groups and evening groups. We had a small business that started with a course that ran at a weekend. And from that, we being a few other physicians, we got together and put a website together and published then some of our questions onto the internet. And it grew very rapidly and took over the day job, really. We were at one point original company that started in our particular area in this type of exam prep. And we grew rapidly over a few years. It took on developers and started thinking, right, okay, this is some proper teaching now. So how are we going to make sure that we're managing and keeping the quality and doing what we're saying we're doing? So that was a great, great learning experience. It was acquired by BMJ, the medical publisher, the whole company, and they carried on with that exam prep business. They took me on to do similar sort of online learning and face-to-face programs, and really enjoyed then developing some innovative programs, blended learning with BMJ in the UK, internationally. I joined and met with a lot of people from the pharmaceutical industry and the supplier and provider industry for medical education during that time, and learned a lot from them. When I left BMJ, I joined a pharmaceutical company at the request of an old friend, a client. And I laughed because I was going from healthcare, practicing healthcare, into medical publishing. And then going into a pharmaceutical company was not on the horizon. But I have enjoyed, I worked and now left UCB. And I spent 5 years there in a global medical education role. And we explored innovative ideas in providing types of learning and measuring learning outcomes. And that's really what's driven me the last few years is looking at how to deliver medical education in a high quality way and focus on the learner's needs, the original learner. So the original driving force was people trying to get through an exam. And subsequently, I've always had a focus and I'm passionate about what the learner wants to get from the program rather than the teacher.
So that's a great question. So first of all, I mean, your career spans a lot of different areas and, you know, is a fairly kind of healthy time trajectory as well. So you must have seen a lot of changes in terms of how education is designed, planned, implemented, and evaluated in these different contexts, in the sort of healthcare / academic context, in the publishing context, and in the context of pharma-led education. But I love your question, your overarching narrative question of how do you do all these things, package education for learners in ways that they need to learn and that address the things they need to learn. So how do you?
There's no magic wand to any of this. But when we were doing exam prep, we had highly motivated learners. They were there for a particular reason. They paid for our resource because we had lots of preparation questions and materials. And they wanted to pass the exam. So they're very determined. They're at the start of their career, and they need to get these exams to get to the next stage of their career. So working with them was really easy because they knew exactly what they wanted, and we just had to ask them and deliver it. The challenge was delivering it fast enough and at scale.
Yeah.
So
that's
what we built expertise in doing. Outside that, so when you attend a learning event yourself, you make lots and lots of judgments about why you're there and what you're trying to achieve. And if you're away for a whole day from your clinical practice, for example, what on earth are you doing? And is any of this going to be any use to you when you go back and see patients? So I think to answer your question, it's important to really focus on what those needs are. The learning has to make sense to the learner so that they can be then really motivated to engage in the material and make use of it for their practice.
And in the publishing world and in pharma-led education, what were some of the strategies that you've been using to determine what those needs are?
Oh, yes, gosh. So you can ask directly. So in the publishing industry, for example, and this is pre-COVID, so these were mostly live events, and we would have face-to-face events, and we would send out a series of tests, knowledge tests. So you'd because of our background in the exam prep, we had expertise in developing test questions. So if there was a topic coming up for the weekend or a Saturday course or something, then we would ask a series of questions and then use that to inform then faculty as to how they would pitch their learning. So what really worked well was you'd share that at the beginning of the meeting. So you'd say, hey, you had our test questions ahead of this, and let's go through them and see how everybody scored on these, you know, case problems that you had. And you can quickly see that some things are well known and understood, and other things are not so well understood. And you could then spend more time as faculty on delivering those types of materials and explaining and having a longer discussion about why those areas are trickier. So that was a good way of like a pre-knowledge test to give you a needs assessment then that you could then use in the live program. And that they were fun to do. And that was in the publishing industry. We would then follow up with identifying then from the learners in the session, what are the sort of materials they enjoy searching for or are useful for the knowledge gaps that have been identified. And because the publisher is host to a wealth of scientific information across different therapy areas, then you could provide then, you know, deep links to the materials, the journals, the review articles, the learning modules that were already developed by the publisher. So that was fun to do. That's one way of doing it. In the pharmaceutical industry, the challenge there is it's a heavily regulated industry, so you don't have necessarily direct access or permission to talk with your learners directly ahead of the event, and squeezing in something like a needs assessment like that might be logistically quite difficult because you have to get permissions in advance and all that. So that sometimes is possible, but I didn't manage to do that in the company that I worked with anyway. But what you can do is you can reinforce the legitimate role of the pharmaceutical industry in helping to deliver and support learning for healthcare professionals. They are the innovators in a scientific space. They fund a lot of research. They develop new therapies, and those therapies cannot be implemented unless they also are supported by additional knowledge and skills and recognition by the healthcare professionals who are going to use the new innovative products. So there's a big legitimate purpose for pharmaceutical industry to be involved there. And one of the key approaches, I feel, is that there should be a reasonably open, transparent, systematic review of the literature to show that this is a real-world problem that we're addressing. This is a therapy area that has practice gaps, and we are going to provide learning designed to close those gaps because we have a shared interest in improving patient care. And that would be the approach then from that regulated industry perspective.
And so that's what I was going to ask you, actually, you know, about pharma-led education in the UK and in Europe, because it seems as though it's a little different there than it is in the US, where, you know, there's a fairly firm division distinction between pharma-led education, which tends to be disease state, speakers programs, those kinds of things, as well as publications and other sorts of materials that medical affairs might put out there into the world, and accredited CME, which is, you know, has its own set of distinct and related regulations and policies. So I guess my question is, when you're talking about pharma-led education, what are you talking about?
It's where that overlap of interest is. It's where the overlap of the healthcare professional and the healthcare system, there's a gap in the care that is being delivered. And when you look at the world of the pharmaceutical company, where it overlaps, where if you imagine a Venn diagram, the overlap of the common interest area, that is the area that is a legitimate area for a pharmaceutical company to be involved in helping develop. Not of interest in that overlap, outside their overlap in the pharmaceutical company is the basic research, the background of the drug development, the delivery of a new product and a new therapy at scale globally. That's not of interest to the necessarily to the healthcare system for learning design, but where the overlap is, where if it's the therapy area, if there are identified practice gaps that can be addressed, then that's the sweet spot, if you like, to concentrate on a company-led education, especially if it's near an innovative new type of therapy, because it will invariably come with the new science that is around there, the latest ideas and experience in that area, and that needs to be told. So that science is something that needs to be shared, and to see where the real common practice gaps are. So I was going to come back as well to the differences between in company-led education. So I think there are differences between the different countries, the US, Europe, and elsewhere. But I think there's far more in common from a pharmaceutical perspective. There's far more in common across those regions than there are differences. Whenever a global program is being considered, or a strategy is being developed, it needs to be linked to the science of the new therapy and innovation and what the practice gaps are. But then when it comes to delivery of the tactics in different regions and countries, that it really depends on the particular circumstances of those areas, how their needs are different. And we rely on colleagues in who have expertise in the different types of regulation that are in different countries, and what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. And you can design a strategy, but then the tactics are going to be different in different regions. And that's why you get the differences. There's no magic or set difference between what is done. It depends on the different types of health context as well.
Yeah, I think some listeners in the US can be surprised at the differences in that healthcare context across Europe, for instance, that there are so many variations in terms of how healthcare is structured and delivered, the clinical roles, the different clinical roles exactly that people have, and also the cultural contexts that healthcare is kind of part of. I am going to ask you, I know you have an interest in outcomes. So what are the changes that you've seen in terms of measuring and evaluating the effectiveness of learning and education programs in these different contexts that you've worked in? Exam board prep, publishing, and pharma-led education.
I think it's been an exciting journey. So I think we are all becoming more familiar with the different types of outcomes that we'd like to measure. The Don Moore's framework that was published, 2009?
Yeah.
Was a really good display of this is the whole range of what is possible, and has helped focus, I think, our industry on the types of things that can be done and how they should be done. We have talked about the pyramid and whether it's something that should be climbed and ascended to the very top, or whether it, you know, each level brings its different types of richness with it. But I think it is great to get past the actual lowest level of attendance, how many turned up. I think that, it's great that we are now looking as an industry at valuing the higher outcomes that we have. What my personal perspective is, I think what we do is we at the moment, we measure a lot of things. We measure lots of stats, and we've got into a, like a data, let's get more data, let's ask more questions, let's look at these things. And the challenge now is that there are societies. I know of one, as I heard one mention in a conference recently. And also I have a client who has a wealth of assessment or evaluation outcomes over the last 5-10 years, but they haven't really dug into it. They haven't done anything with it. So there's a lot of data points now. We're collecting more data points, but I think it would be good to now be a bit more rational and think, well, why are we measuring that? And when we do measure it, what we're going to do with it? So I think it's good to have that conversation too.
Now, am I right in thinking you've been involved in the outcome standardization project? Am I making that up?
No, I wasn't. I've been a noisy cheerleader.
You've been a noisy cheerleader, right? That'll work.
supporting it, because I think when you look at the abstract, say in one of the congresses, say like the Alliance meeting, you can go around and you can look at the methods that were used in the different papers, and they'll have a whole wealth of different types of outcomes measures and definitions of things. So it's important, I think, to try to standardize those, and my hat is taken off to those that have put the first draft of that through. So that's good to see. Brian McGowan, isn't it, has been involved.
Yes, and Greg Salinas and Wendy Sorrenthia, and there's a bunch of people involved in that project. But I like the visual of the bystanding cheerleader, because that works as well. This episode of Right Medicine is brought to you by Right CME Pro, a professional development membership that provides skills and scaffolding for medical writers who want to create CME content with confidence. Right CME Pro gives you access to expert perspectives to help you build your CME writing skills, a portfolio accelerator to hold space so that you can create stunning samples to show your prospects, group coaching to help you build foundational and expert knowledge in CME, and much, much more. Right CME Pro is a professional development membership for people like you who are ready to launch and grow a specialized CME medical writing niche. See the link in the show notes for more information about how to enroll. You know, and I guess the kind of follow-up question there is, you know, there's a question of what's the value of standardization, but how do you see the field actually moving forward in terms of outcomes measurement and evaluation and analysis? Because certainly, you know, on the writer's side of things, you know, often as a medical writer, you're involved in putting together outcomes reports and using the analysis to generate, you know, a narrative and tell a story about, you know, education activities and how they've been effective, what they've achieved. But how do you see the field kind of responding to the, you know, the idea of standardized outcomes? What's the next step?
I'm not sure where it will go, but anybody who's familiar with the education literature, if you look at any concept in education, usually when a paper is written, they have to define what they mean by the different terms that they're going to be using in that approach, because theories and theorists within the theories change their position as evidence changes and opinion changes. Then
it's Kuhn's paradigm shift, isn't it?
Yeah. So there certainly is a drive, and the huge, you know, change that has taken place globally with the pandemic, the tools that we use now that are like they were brought 10 years forward from in our, we were advocating for this before the pandemic, but they were brought like 10 years ahead of time, which is great. But we have then a lot of capability then to standardize on what we are measuring. For any of the larger companies involved, pharmaceutical companies or providers, it is in their best interest, obviously, to try and standardize, because they're trying to work on their internal processes to become efficient, to be able to know what they do in one area, how they, that compares to another area. And if you can only compare things if you are measuring the same sort of thing in different places. So I think there's a lot of support for standardization. Whether you actually achieve it is, I think, wishful thinking, because I think you can't necessarily standardize absolutely everything, because every therapy areas are different. Surgery is different to internal medicine, is different to pediatrics, and you're going to get different types of uses for different types of outcome measures there. So there are plenty of outcomes measures as well published in the CME literature that are there, validated, but little used, which I think is a loss to us as a discipline. We should, I think, dig out a few of those and look at them first before inventing necessarily our own.
Yeah, it sounds like a challenge there. Certainly, a project. Do you think that, certainly in the US, I can't speak for the UK and Europe, the CME CPD field is, you know, it's been professionalizing slowly over the last, you know, 10, 15 years. And that the kinds of things that you're talking about there, you know, are part of a scholarly mindset. The idea that scholarship is a foundation for professionalization. You need to have that as one of the sort of driving engines. It feels like, okay, that thread of professionalization is a little slower to kind of make purchase with the fabric, to keep that analogy going, certainly in the US. Is that something you see? That there needs to be internal capacity building within the field to make that type of comparison and scholarship just part of what we do. I don't necessarily think we're there at the moment, but we're heading in that direction. It's a theory. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the professional qualifications that colleagues are seeking and getting, I think that's a really encouraging move, because it cements the discipline. I think in the States, I think that seems to be a little bit more advanced in the medical learning professional approach. In UK and Europe, I think it depends on the skills are acquired perhaps sometimes outside the industry and bringing it in that learning expertise in then from elsewhere. In the pharmaceutical industry, I think there has been an encouraging move towards bringing in that expertise into medical affairs, and organizations like MAPS, for example, have done a lot of work in pulling together the know-how of medical affairs professionals in learning, in the area of learning expertise. However, I think the industry is under pressure to integrate across medical affairs and speed up the work that is that medical affairs needs to do. So other challenges are coming, how they work with omni-channel approach to your healthcare professionals, and how that links with learning or information sharing, then that's also a challenge for them. So I think there is a current struggle in working out what expertise is required in medical affairs teams and how best to get that.
And in Europe and the UK, what is the degree of collaboration between medical affairs teams and colleagues in independent medical education, who also may, of course, be under the broader medical affairs umbrella?
By collaboration, how do you mean? Sorry, what's sort of setting up?
Yeah, what's the kind of relationship between medical affairs and independent medical education within a pharmaceutical manufacturer in the UK and Europe? So in the US, for instance, there will be often IME will sit within medical affairs. Is that the same kind of structure in Europe?
I think it varies more by different company than by geographical region. So
got it.
Decisions are made on how a company is structured and at a global level, and that defines more what functions are in different areas of medical affairs than just the geography. clearly with Europe, because the language and cultural differences of many countries all in one place, all under one big regulatory authority. And then you've got the UK separate as well. So I think there's a localized expertise needed there to be able to work out what is the best function and who does what and how you commission independent medical education, how you work with providers to deliver what you think is important to close those gaps that you've identified, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Yeah, it does. It does. So just in the interest, you know, as we kind of wrap up, I wondered if you could tell us something a little bit about Outcomes Engine. What is it? Why is it important?
Well, my passion, as I said, is in the learner and what they want to get out of something. Since leaving the pharmaceutical company, I've looked to set up a consultancy service that can then could work with providers and pharmaceutical colleagues and societies, university partners, to look at how we can improve the measurement in the design using those measurements of different types of learning. An Outcomes Engine is one of those, is the company that I've formed, but also it hosts some of the tools. So the survey instruments that I mentioned that are in the CME literature, some of them then are available as an easy way to deliver them through the Outcomes Engine. Or, you know, they could be delivered in a more traditional manner or through different platforms as well. So that's my current passion, is to try and build my links in the industry from my past experience and carry on the work then that I'm really keen on developing, of getting that learner's voice out. Rather than having the statisticians, if you like, averaging everything, and you say, we asked the class and they got like 50% or something. That's great and accurate, but it doesn't help the individual learner. And we know that learning is non-linear. Some people can learn an enormous amount from one lecture, whereas somebody else might not find it helpful at all. And we need to capture that richness as well, because they all are going to go back to clinical practice and apply what we are delivering for them. So that's what Outcomes Engine is. And we talk about and are passionate about measuring and making use of the measurements when we get them.
So I'm really interested in what you mean by capturing the learner's voice, because to me that screams qualitative, but I'm wondering what you mean by that.
I'm really passionate about the qualitative side, because I think if you want to capture the complexity of healthcare, you have to have the learner's individual experience and how it applies to their practice. So the famous fable, I don't know if I can drift into a fable, is
drift,
of the
away.
Three statisticians go hunting in the forest, okay? And they find a fat pigeon on a tree. One of them shoots and misses by an inch. I'll keep it American units. And the other one, and the second statistician shoots, but misses in the other direction, to the right by an inch as well. And the third statistician lifts the gun, but then thinks, oh, no, there's no need, because on average, we hit the pigeon. So I think that tries to capture what the pigeon's voice, but the learner's voice can be missed if you just rely on quantitative measurements and averaging out for a whole class. You'll miss on the richness of what actually happened. So I'll leave that as a way of explaining the combination.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I completely agree. I mean, I've actually a qualitative researcher, so I've worked on a lot of outcomes projects where there's a qualitative component built in. So we're asking the learners directly, at the end of an activity, what's been valuable for them, what the drivers of change have been, and all those sorts of things. So I'm curious how Outcomes Engine will do that.
Well, principally by supporting those who are providing learning to consider and think through why they're measuring what they're measuring. And in fact, decide what you're going to measure before you actually design everything else, rather than using the outcome, the evaluation form as the last thing that you design just before the first speaker goes on stage. Think of what you actually intend to deliver first, how you're going to measure it, and then how you're going to actually get that measurement right by your learning design. And it may be very different to how you think it should have been designed, because it depends on what sort of outcome you want. But the simple example that I gave to colleagues a lot in recent years was that the difference between workshops. So if you want to develop a skill, you need people to be in a workshop to talk and experiment with a skill. You can't expect them to gather a skill somehow from a set of PowerPoints or an e-learning program. They have to actually
do
engage
it.
In the skill. Do the skill.
Yeah, see one, do one, teach one.
Exactly.
Yeah, the doing is key. Dean, is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you wish I had before we wrap up?
I don't think so, Alex. I think you've covered everything.
We've covered pigeons.
40 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think basically there's no easy. People who are new to this sort of area, isn't it? Education is a social science.
Yes.
So if somebody asks, oh, what's the answer? How do you do it? The answer is not straightforward. It's a discipline that is rewarding in other ways. It doesn't have simple answers. It has a lot of sometimes complex answers.
Complex answers that we need to get better at documenting and sharing with each other in the community. And yeah, I like to describe thing in threes, but I can't think of a third thing. So that's okay. That's a place to stop.
And get it published.
Yes. And sharing with the community internally and getting things published and out there into the public domain. Dean Jenkins, outcomes enthusiast, teller of pigeon jokes. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and insights with listeners of Right Medicine.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks.
Here are my takeaways from my conversation with Dean. CME must evolve to meet the complex and personalised needs of learners, incorporating a more dynamic, qualitative approach to assess learning outcomes. The CME field has been steadily shifting toward valuing outcomes beyond attendance and satisfaction for well over a decade now, probably longer. But it remains challenging to analyse the collective data and use it to further improve the learning experience. Standardisation of outcomes measurement is vital for the professionalisation of CME and CPD. This insight highlights the ongoing need for innovation in learning measurement, just as Dean does through his work with Outcomes Engine. And it reminds me too of the work that Sarah Nisley, Caroline Pardo and colleagues have been doing to reimagine the future of CME and CPD. They shared some of their insights on episode 94 of Right Medicine, and they've recently published a follow-up article in the Alliance Almanac. A top-ranked theme in their research is the need to adopt theory-based evaluation frameworks that capture the complexities of practice change within healthcare contexts. If that's the case, we need to start building the skills and capabilities infrastructure now to support this future. And finally, sharing insights and validated findings within the CME and CPD community is beneficial and necessary to foster improvement in education and ultimately patient care. As Dean says, engaging with a broader community of educators, learners, and health professionals through discussion forums, journals, or social media networks is valuable. So if you're not already doing so, share your findings, experiences, and strategies for measuring and improving educational outcomes. That's it for today. We're back on April the 5th with First Friday, when writer Michelle Guillemard will be talking about lifelong learning and self-improvement, how to embrace technology to your advantage, and how to build a specialised niche. In the meantime, make sure you don't miss out on Right Medicine episodes. Click follow or subscribe on your favourite listening platform. Thanks for listening. Stay curious and keep learning.